as solid and dazzling as Beowulf's funeral pyre that is set ablaze at the end. These opening and closing scenes retain a haunting presence in the mind. They are set pieces, but they have the life-marking power of certain dreams. They are like the pillars of the Gate of Horn, through which wise dreams of true art can still be said to pass. What happens in between is what William Butler Yeats would have called a phantasmagoria. Three agones, three struggles in which the preternatural force for evil of the hero's enemies comes springing at him in demonic shapes. Three encounters with what the critical literature and the textbook glossaries call the monsters. In three archetypal sites of fear, the barricaded nighthouse, the infested underwater current, and the reptile-haunted rocks of a wilderness. If we think of the poem in this way, its place in world art becomes clearer and more secure. We can conceive of it as represented and transformed in performance in a bunraku theatre in Japan, where the puppetry and the poetry are mutually supportive, a mixture of technicolor spectacle and ritual chant. Or we can equally envisage it as an animated cartoon, and there has been at least one shot of this already, full of mutating graphics and minatory stereophonics. We can avoid, at any rate, the slightly cardboard effect which the word monster tends to introduce, and give the poem a fresh chance to sweep in off the moors, down through the mist bands of Anglo-Saxon England, forward into the global village of the third millennium. Nevertheless, the dream element and overall power to haunt come at a certain readerly price. The poem abounds in passages which will leave an unprepared audience bewildered. Just when the narrative seems ready to take another step ahead into the main Beowulf story, it sidesteps. For a moment, it is as if we have been channel-surfed into another poem. And at two points in this translation, I indicate that we are, in fact, participating in a poem within our poem by a slight quickening of pace and shortening of the metrical rein. The passages occur in lines 883 to 914 and lines 1070 to 1158. And on each occasion, a minstrel has begun to chant a poem as part of the celebration of Beowulf's achievement. In the former case, the minstrel expresses his praise by telling the story of Sigemund's victory over a dragon, which both parallels Beowulf's triumph over Grendel and prefigures his fatal encounter with the worm in his old age. In the latter, the most famous of what were once called the digressions in the poem, the one dealing with a fight between Danes and Frisians at the stronghold of Finn, the Frisian king, the song the minstrel sings has a less obvious bearing on the immediate situation of the hero, but its import is nevertheless central to both the historical and the imaginative world of the poem. The Finnsburg episode envelops us in a society that is at once honour-bound and blood-stained, presided over by the laws of the blood feud, where the kin of a person slain are bound to exact a price for the death, either by slaying the killer or by receiving satisfaction in the form of weregild, the man price, a legally fixed compensation. The claustrophobic and doom-laden atmosphere of this interlude gives the reader an intense intimation of what word, or fate, meant not only to the characters in the Finn story, but to those participating in the main action of Beowulf itself. All conceive of themselves as hooped within the great wheel of necessity, in thrall to a code of loyalty and bravery, bound to seek glory in the eye of the warrior world. The little nations are grouped around their lord. The greater nations spoil for war and menace the little ones. A lord dies, defenselessness ensues, the enemy strikes, vengeance for the dead becomes an ethic for the living, bloodshed begets further bloodshed, the wheel turns, the generations tread and tread and tread. Which is what I meant before when I said that the import of the Finsburg passage is central to the historical and imaginative world of the poem as a whole. One way of reading Beowulf is to think of it as three agones in the hero's life, but another way would be to regard it as a poem which contemplates the destinies of three peoples by tracing their interweaving histories in the story of the central character. First, we meet the Danes, variously known as the Scyldings, after Scyld Chieftain, the founder of their line, the Ingwins, the Spear Danes, the Bright Danes, the West Danes, and so on, a people in the full summer of their power, symbolized by the high hall built by King Hrothgar, one meant to be a wonder of the world. The threat to this gilded order comes from within, from marshes beyond the pale, from the bottom of the haunted mere where Cain's clan, in the shape of Grendel and his troll dam, trawl and scavenge and bide their time. But it also comes from without, from the Heathobards, for example, whom the Danes have defeated in battle and from whom they can therefore expect retaliatory war. Beowulf actually predicts this turn of events when he goes back to his own country after saving the Danes, for the time being at any rate, by staving off the two Reavers from Hell. In the hall of his ring-giver, Hugh-Yalok, Lord of the Geats, the hero discourses about his adventures in a securely fortified cliff-top enclosure. But this security is only temporary, for it is the destiny of the Geat people to be left lordless in the end. Hugh-Yalok's alliances eventually involve him in a deadly war with the Swedish king, Ongentheow. And even though he does not personally deliver the fatal stroke, he is known in the poem as Ongentheow's killer. Hence it comes to pass that after the death of Beowulf, who eventually succeeds Hugh-Yalok, the Geats experience a great foreboding, and the epic closes in a mood of somber expectation. A world is passing away, the Swedes and others are massing on the borders to attack, and there is no lord or hero to rally the defence. The Swedes, therefore, are the third nation whose history and destiny are woven into the narrative. And even though no part of the main action is set in their territory, they and their kings constantly stalk the horizon of dread within which the main protagonists pursue their conflicts and allegiances. The Swedish dimension gradually becomes an important element in the poem's emotional and imaginative geography. A geography which entails, it should be said, no very clear map sense of the world, more an apprehension of menaced borders, of danger gathering beyond the mere and the marshes, of Merch Stapus prowling the moors, huge marauders from some other world. Within these phantasmal boundaries, each lord's hall is an actual and a symbolic refuge. Here is heat and light, rank and ceremony, human solidarity and culture. The Duguth share the mead benches with the Yawgoth, the veterans with their tales of warrior kings and hero saviors from the past rub shoulders with young braves, Thanus, Erlus, Thanes, retainers, keen to win such renown in the future. The prospect of gaining a glorious name in the Walras, in the rush of battle slaughter, the pride of defending one's lord and bearing heroic witness to the integrity of the bond between him and his hall companions, a bond sealed in the glao and gid of peacetime feasting and ring-giving. This is what gave drive and sanction to the Germanic warrior culture enshrined in Beowulf. Heorot and Hugh-Yalok's hall are the hubs of this value system upon which the poem's action turns. But there is another outer rim of value, a circumference of understanding within which the heroic world is occasionally viewed as from a distance and recognized for what it is, an earlier state of consciousness and culture, one which has not been altogether shed, but which has now been comprehended as part of another pattern. And this circumference and pattern arise, of course, from the poet's Christianity and from his perspective as an Englishman, looking back at places and legends which his ancestors knew before they made their migration from continental Europe to their new home on the island of the Britons. As a consequence of his doctrinal certitude, which is as composed as it is ardent, the poet can view the story time of his poem with a certain historical detachment and even censure the ways of those who lived in illo tempore. Sometimes at pagan shrines they vowed offerings to idols, swore oaths that the killer of souls might come to their aid and save the people. That was their way, their heathenish hope. Deep in their hearts, they remembered hell. At the same time, as a result of his inherited vernacular culture and the imaginative sympathy which distinguishes him as an artist, the poet can lend the full weight of his rhetorical power to Beowulf as he utters the first principles of the Northern warrior's honour code. It is always better to avenge dear ones than to indulge in mourning, for every one of us living in this world means waiting for our end. Let whoever can win glory before death. When a warrior is gone, that will be his best and only bulwark. In an age when the instability of the human subject is constantly argued for, if not presumed, there should be no problem with a poem which is woven from two such different psychic fabrics. In fact, Beowulf perfectly answers the early modern conception of a work of creative imagination as one in which conflicting realities find accommodation within a new order, and this reconciliation occurs, it seems to me, most poignantly and most profoundly in the poem's third section, once the dragon enters the picture, and the hero in old age must gather his powers for the final climactic ordeal. From the moment Beowulf advances under the crags, into the comfortless arena bounded by the rock wall, the reader knows he is one of those marked by fate. The poetry is imbued with a strong intuition of word hovering close, unknowable but certain, and yet, because it is imagined with a consciousness which has learned to expect that the soul will find an ultimate home among the steadfast ones, this primal human emotion has been transmuted into something less zero at the bone, more metaphysically tempered. A similar transposition from a plane of regard which is, as it were, helmeted and hall-bound to one which sees things in a slightly more heavenly light is discernible in the different ways the poet imagines gold. Gold is a constant element, gleaming solidly in underground vaults, on the breasts of queens or the arms and regalia of warriors on the mead benches. It is loaded into boats as spoil, handed out in bent bars as hall gifts, buried in the earth as treasure, persisting underground as an affirmation of a people's glorious past and an elegy for it. It pervades the ethos of the poem the way sex pervades consumer culture. And yet, the bullion with which Wals's son, Sigemund, weighs down the hold after an earlier dragon-slaying triumph, in the old days, long before Beowulf's time, is a more trustworthy substance than that which is secured behind the walls of Beowulf's barrow. By the end of the poem, gold has suffered a radiation from the Christian vision. It is not that it yet equals riches in the medieval sense of worldly corruption, just that its status as the ore of all value has been put in doubt. It is lana, transitory, passing from hand to hand, and its changed status is registered as a symptom of the changed world. Once the dragon is disturbed, the melancholy and sense of displacement which pervade the last movement of the poem enter the hoard as a disabling and ominous light. And the dragon himself, as a genius of the older order, is bathed in this light, so that even as he begins to stir, the reader has a premonition that the days of his empire are numbered. Nevertheless, the dragon has a wonderful inevitability about him and a unique glamour. It is not that the other monsters are lacking in presence and aura. It is more that they remain, for all their power to terrorize, creatures of the physical world. Grendel comes alive in the reader's imagination as a kind of dog breath in the dark, a fear of collision with some hard-boned and immensely strong android frame, a mixture of Caliban and Hoplite. And while his mother, too, has a definite brute-bearing about her, a creature of slouch and lunge on land, if seal-swift in the water, she nevertheless retains a certain non-strangeness. As antagonists of a hero being tested, Grendel and his mother possess an appropriate head-on strength. The poet may need them as figures who do the devil's work, but the poem needs them more as figures who call up and show off Beowulf's physical might and his superb gifts as a warrior. They are the right enemies for a young glory hunter, instigators of the formal boast, worthy trophies to be carried back from the grim testing ground. Grendel's arm is ripped off and nailed up, his head severed and paraded in Heorot. It's all consonant with the surge of youth and the compulsion to win fame, as wide as the wind's home, as the sea around cliffs, utterly a manifestation of the Germanic heroic code. Enter then, 50 years later, the dragon. From his dry stone vault, from a nest where he is heaped in coils around the body-heated gold. Once he is wakened, there is something glorious in the way he manifests himself, a 4th of July effulgence fireworking its path across the night sky. And yet, because of the centuries he has spent dormant in the tumulus, there is a foundedness as well as a lambency about him. He is at once a stratum of the earth and a streamer in the air. No painted dragon, but a figure of real oniric power, one that can easily survive the prejudice which arises at the very mention of the word dragon. Whether in medieval art or in modern Disney cartoons, the dragon can strike us as far less horrific than he is meant to be. But in the final movement of Beowulf, he lodges himself in the imagination as word rather than worm, more a destiny than a set of reptilian vertebrae. Grendel and his mother enter Beowulf's life from the outside, accidentally, challenges which in other circumstances he might not have taken up, enemies from whom he might have been distracted or deflected. The dragon, on the other hand, is a given of his home ground, abiding in his under-earth as in his understanding, waiting for the meeting, the watcher at the ford, the questioner who sits so sly, the lion limb, as Gerard Manley Hopkins might have called him, against whom Beowulf's body and soul must measure themselves. Dragon equals shadow line, the psalmist's valley of the shadow of death, the embodiment of a knowledge deeply ingrained in the species, which is the very knowledge of the price to be paid for physical and spiritual survival. It has often been observed that all the scriptural references in Beowulf are to the Old Testament. The poet is more in sympathy with the tragic, waiting, unredeemed phase of things than with any transcendental promise. Beowulf's mood as he gets ready to fight the dragon, who could be read as a projection of Beowulf's own thonic wisdom refined in the crucible of experience, recalls the mood of other tragic heroes. Oedipus at Colonus, Lear at his ripeness is all extremity, Hamlet in the last illuminations of his prophetic soul. No easy bargain would be made in that place by any man. The veteran king sat down on the cliff top. He wished good luck to the Geats who had shared his hearth and his gold. He was sad at heart, unsettled yet ready, sensing his death. His fate hovered near, unknowable, but certain. Here,